For this Monday, June 15th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. A major victory for LGBTQ rights with today's Supreme Court ruling protecting gay and transgender workers from discrimination. The number of coronavirus cases continues to spread with an uptick in a number of states that loosened restrictions early on, including Arizona, Texas, and Florida, now reporting their highest numbers yet. 22 states in all are seeing a rise in COVID-19 cases. Washington Post financial writer David Lynch says all of this could mean that the economic recovery will be much slower than first anticipated. He'll join us to explain later in the program. And the White House is threatening legal action over the release of John Bolton's new book, The Room Where It Happened. The former National Security Advisor claims the president did indeed commit impeachable offenses. It's scheduled to come out next week. The story shaping Washington Today, it's all ahead here on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin at the Supreme Court with today's landmark decision, a ruling that states federal workplace law prohibits employers from firing gay, lesbian, and transgender workers. The justices split in a 6-3 decision, with Justice Neil Gorsuch writing the majority opinion. He was joined by the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, as well as the court's liberal wing. Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Samuel Alito wrote separate dissents, and Justice Clarence Thomas joining Alito's dissent. Well, the court's decision came in three cases which focused closely on the text of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bars discrimination based on employers, quote, because of sex. During oral arguments last October, attorney Jeffrey Harris joining the U.S. Solicitor General, arguing that sexual orientation and gender identity issues should be decided by Congress, not by the Supreme Court. In addition to attorney Harris, you will hear from Justices Brett Kavanaugh and Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Are you drawing a distinction between the literal meaning of because of sex and the ordinary meaning of because of sex? And if so, how are we supposed to think about ordinary meaning in this case?
I don't see a difference between the two as far as and the last point, running out of time, I think to go back to some of the questions about bathrooms and fitness standards, I want to be clear. Under the plaintiff's simple but for test, if you truly simply apply the Manhart test or in the way they want to do it, I don't see any way that single-sex bathrooms or showering facilities.
You have to have someone who's injured. You have to have someone who's injured. And the response to the bathrooms is, who is the complaining plaintiff? And for most people, they would not be complaining plaintiff. They would not be eligible because they're not injured by the separate bathrooms. In fact, they like it.
Yes, Your Honor. Although, of course, if someone, for example, is fired, imagine a factory with hazardous materials where people shower after work and to clean up, and a man used the women's bathroom and is fired, that person would certainly be injured. And I think under my friend's test, they would say, just change the sex, and that person wouldn't have been fired. But here's the problem. That's not a similarly situated person. The proper analysis would say that a neutral policy, such as use the showering facility that corresponds to your biological sex. The man who uses the women's shower, the comparator is not a woman who uses the woman's shower. It's a woman who uses the men's shower, because otherwise you're not – otherwise you're loading the dice or you're not looking at similarly situated people. And the last thing I'd like to get into is this court in Espinoza, footnote 2, I think there was some discussion of the states early on. In Espinoza, in interpreting national origin discrimination, this court said that the state practice interpreting parallel laws is highly instructive. And so I think the fact that 22 or 23 states have done this by legislation and zero have done it by judicial interpretation just shows that this isn't belt and suspenders. It's not just redundancy, that sex and sexual orientation, both in 1964 and today, are different concepts that mean different things, and common users of language both today and in 1964 would have recognized that.
Just part of the argument from last October, and of course 1964, referring to the Civil Rights Act. Well, today's Supreme Court ruling, a 6-3 decision, stating that you cannot fire someone if they are gay, lesbian, or transgender. In his 54-page dissent, Associate Justice Samuel Alito writing the following, quote, "There is only one word for what the court has done today, legislation. The document that the court releases is in the form of a judicial opinion interpreting a statute, but that is deceptive. And Justice Alito noted that numerous bills have been introduced over the last 45 years that would specifically add, quote, sexual orientation and gender identity to the protections under Title VII, but to date, none has passed both houses. That from Justice Alito. Well, Stanford Law Professor Pamela Carlin represented the gay and lesbian employees from last October. Oral arguments, you'll hear from her, along with Justice Alito and Associate Justice Stephen Breyer.
May I ask you to respond to what some people will say about this court if we rule in your favor? And what they will say is that whether Title VII should prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is a big policy issue, and it is a different policy issue from the one that Congress thought it was addressing in 1964. And Congress has been asked repeatedly in the years since 1964 to address this question. The Equality Act is before Congress right now. Congress has declined or failed to act on these requests. And if the court takes this up and interprets this 1964 statute to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, we will be acting exactly like a legislature. We might as well just take the Equality Act and issue that as our opinion and say, as Judge Posner said, that the courts need to intervene on questions like this when the legislative branch simply will not do so. What would we — how would we respond to that question?
Well, the fact that a loose cannon like Judge Posner says, do whatever you feel like, is not what we're asking for. We're saying if you read the words because of sex and you ask in 1964, what did those words mean? They meant treating men differently from women. So if in 1964 it would be discrimination to fire a woman who wanted to, you know, a woman who enjoyed sewing, and there's a famous case, it's the foundational case on sexual orientation where they fired a man who said his
body was — we would not be deciding a major policy question that was not in Congress's mind in 1964 and that Congress has repeatedly failed to address in the years since then.
No more than what you did in Ancal, no more than what you did in Price Waterhouse, no more than what you did in Newport News.
The audio from last October's oral arguments, by the way, it's available on our website at cspan.org. And joining us on the phone is Rebecca Rainey. She covers labor and immigration issues for Politico. What's the backstory on this case, and in particular, one of the plaintiffs, Gerald Lynn Bostock?
Yeah, so Gerald Bostock, he worked for a Clayton County government in Georgia in January 2003. Well, he started working there in 2003, and he worked on advocating for at-risk children as a child welfare service coordinator in that area. And so he said, according to his legal filings, that he had received favorable performance evaluations and was given primary responsibility for this advocacy program to help find guardians in some jurisdictions to assist and protect children whose physical or mental health was at risk. And so when at some point Mr. Bostock began to participate in a gay recreational softball league called the Hotlanta Softball League, and his participation eventually became criticized by someone within the court system, according to his court filings. And later, in about 2013, he started to be subject of an internal audit from the program that he worked for. And later, he was terminated. And the reason for his termination was conduct unbecoming of a county employee. And again, he says that he never engaged in any misconduct regarding his work, and that the sole reason for the discrimination against him was because of his sexual orientation and his public participation in that softball league.
And so in today's 6-3 decision, Neil Gorsuch, appointed by President Trump, Chief Justice John Roberts, appointed by President George W. Bush, siding with the Democrats, you're calling it a surprising 6-3 victory. How significant was today's ruling?
I think it's it's got a broad reach. It is very, this ruling, while it only applies to Title VII, there are several other statutes regarding sex discrimination that bar sex discrimination using some of that same language, such as barring discrimination on the basis of sex. So what we could see, some advocates are pointing out that this could also apply to, of course, this Affordable Care Act rule change that we saw last week that prevents discrimination based on transgender status when it comes to healthcare under the Affordable Care Act. There are also suggestions that this could apply in school discrimination. Now, the justices say specifically in this ruling that they are not addressing some of those issues, such as transgender bathrooms, locker rooms, or anything else of that kind. And it's going to be really up to the lower courts to kind of sort out the questions as to how this applies to other statutes regarding discrimination. However, talking with advocates from the Human Rights Campaign, they maintain that they plan to ensure that this standard of what constitutes discrimination under the Civil Rights Act is applied to both state and federal laws that prohibit sex discrimination.
And in the dissent by Justices Thomas, Alito, and Kavanaugh, basically making the argument that this is something that Congress needs to address, not the Supreme Court. Will Congress in any way take up the issue?
So Congress actually has already addressed this issue in some way. Last May, as in May 2019, the House passed the Equality Act, which would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity in housing, employment, credit, and federally funded programs, among various other areas. But that bill did not go anywhere in the Republican-controlled Senate. So while advocates are calling on lawmakers to codify this this decision, we will have to see how the Senate moves forward on this. And they, in the past, have been opposed to advancing this kind of legislation.
More details at Politico.com. The headline, the Supreme Court finds federal law bars the LGBTQ discrimination in the workplace. Rebecca Rainey, thank you for being with us.
Of course.
And more reaction to the Supreme Court ruling today in a conference call. This from Alfonso Davis. He is the president of the Human Rights Campaign.
But our fight for justice does not end with this ruling. We still need to address significant gaps in federal civil rights laws and improve protections for everyone. The mechanism to do that is the Equality Act. The Equality Act would provide comprehensive protections for LGBTQ people in all facets of life, including many aspects of the public square, such as stores and restaurants and hotels. We need to make sure that LGBTQ people are free of discrimination in all aspects of life. And at the Human Rights Campaign, we are going to continue fighting for full equality for all members of our community. We will continue to advocate for the Equality Act. We will continue to help elect Joe Biden as the next president of the United States. He has vowed to make the Equality Act a top priority. We will also fight to protect the pro-equality majority in the House of Representatives that we helped elect in 2018 and push to elect a pro-equality majority to the U.S. Senate in November.
That from Alfonso Davis from the HRC Human Rights Campaign in a video conference and teleconference earlier today. And at the White House, there was this from President Trump.
Go ahead, please.
Do you have any reaction to the Supreme Court decisions earlier today about LGBT discrimination, saying that is protected under the Civil Rights Act?
No, they've ruled. I've read the decision, and some people were surprised, but they've ruled, and we live with their decision. That's what it's all about. We live with the decision of the Supreme Court. Very powerful, a very powerful decision, actually. But they have so ruled.
That from the president earlier today. You're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. On C-SPAN's The Weekly, our guest is Margaret Brennan. She is the moderator of CBS's Face the Nation. And we discuss the role Sunday morning programs play in American politics and public policy, the rapid changes in our 24/7 cable and digital media landscape, and how to get straight answers from a newsmaker guest. If that guest is President Trump, it's often a real challenge.
You, as the interviewer, have to kind of keep your eye on the ball throughout it. Okay, I can follow you down the hard right turn you just took there or the hard left turn you just took there, or I can stay on the original question that I was seeking the answer to in the first place.
Join us for more of our conversation with CBS News Face the Nation moderator, Margaret Brennan. It's on C-SPAN's The Weekly, available at cspan.org/podcasts. And after you listen, be sure to rate and review us and follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. For this Monday, June 15th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. The president is going after former Attorney General Jeff Sessions in his hometown. The president holding a rally next month in Mobile, Alabama, to campaign for Tommy Tuberville. He is former Senator Sessions' opponent in the Senate GOP runoff election. The rally expected to be held just days ahead of a July 14th runoff election for the seat formerly held by Sessions before he was appointed as Attorney General for the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And Joe Biden's presidential campaign and the DNC raising nearly $81 million in May, marking their single best month of fundraising for the 2020 cycle. In other news, the wife of Rashard Brooks, who was shot by police outside a Wendy's restaurant in Atlanta on Friday, telling NBC News that she cannot even watch the videos of her husband being killed. Tomika Miller said it was supposed to be a weekend to celebrate their daughter's 8th birthday. Instead, she is planning for a funeral. And a family attorney says that there was no reason for the use of deadly force on a man who was running away from the officers. Here's part of her interview with NBC's Craig Melvin.
Tell us about her dad. Tell us about Rashard. What do you want the world to know about Rashard Brooks? What kind of man was he?
My husband was a great man. He was an awesome father, awesome husband. He was loving, kind. He was about unity and just helping people with peace. And he was funny. He was just the joy. I mean, if you were sad or you were down, he was always doing something to make you happy or to tell you, hey, stay positive, it's going to be okay. It's not always going to be that way. He was just a very good person all the way around. Even when he was upset, he held it in. You wouldn't know. You have to make him talk about it.
How are you going to explain to your daughter what happened?
Well, I don't even know how to answer that. I don't know how I'm going to explain it to her because I still can't understand it right now, and I'm really thinking that she doesn't understand that her father's never coming back home.
With that from Tomika Miller on NBC News earlier today, her husband Rashard Brooks was 27 years old. They are, in fact, the parents of four young children, including an 8-year-old who was celebrating her birthday over the weekend. Video released by the Atlanta Police Department showing officers talking to Rashard Brooks for nearly half an hour. The struggle ensued when they tried to handcuff him, and he was able to grab a taser. A white officer who fired the deadly shot was fired himself from the police force, the Atlanta police chief resigning over the weekend. And the Fulton County Medical Examiner's Office ruling that the death was a homicide, finding that he was shot twice in the back, though investigators have not yet determined whether the officers committed a crime. And on Capitol Hill, lawmakers looking at legislative action to rein in the misuse of force on suspects by police, especially African-American men. Representative Karen Bass, the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, is taking the lead in drafting legislation that both Democrats and Republicans can agree to in the House. During a Washington Post live event earlier today, she discussed some of her proposals, including calls to defund the police.
Police officers are the first ones to say that they are law enforcement officers. They're not social workers. What we have done in our country is we have not invested in health, social, and economic problems in communities, and we leave the police to pick up the pieces. So in my city, for example, on any given night, we have over 40,000 people who are homeless. Why should the police be involved with that? You know, if you're talking about a substance abuse issue, if you're talking about a person with intellectual challenges, you know, why should police officers have to clean up society's problems? So one of the main points that I believe the quote-unquote defund movement is making is that cities and states, their priorities are lopsided. So a large percentage of the city budget goes to law enforcement. They're saying, why doesn't the city deal with its social problems so not so much money would have to go to law enforcement? And you know, within the bill, now we do have a grant program where community-based organizations can apply to come up with innovative solutions or strategies about law enforcement in their particular communities.
That from Representative Karen Bass. She is the head of the Congressional Black Caucus, and the full interview is available online at WashingtonPost.com. Meanwhile, the president's counsel, Kellyanne Conway, confirming to Fox News in an interview with Harris Faulkner that the president will be announcing new executive action on law enforcement amid the protests that have sparked the deaths of George Floyd and more recently over the weekend in Atlanta over the death of Rashard Brooks. More from Fox News earlier today.
You know, as we go forward today, I'm wondering what the discussion is like inside the White House after this latest shooting.
Well, there's a great deal of discussion, Harris. Obviously, the entire country, the world, in fact, watched the tape of George Floyd from several weeks ago now in great disgust and horror. I've said that he was murdered before our eyes, a slow and senseless murder. That is true. And now we today see another family heartbroken because of what's happened in Atlanta. I certainly don't want to involve myself in the investigation that your reporter just said will be taking place in Atlanta where it belongs. But everybody should feel grief and sorrow for the family of Rashard Brooks. And again, we have to heal. We have to, I think, you know, people here in Washington, D.C., Nancy Pelosi, let's just take down some statues. I mean, how is that a response to what we see on these tapes, and how will we ever heal? But I want to tell you in no uncertain terms, and not just because I have a law degree, liberty and justice for all means everyone. And we're a fragile and young democracy. Women have had the right to vote for about 100 years this summer, and the Civil Rights Act was within most people's lifetimes. And we're a fragile democracy, and we have to get this right for all Americans. So to the extent that we are expressing our pain and our grief for others, I thought her composure and presence of mind through her grief, this is a senseless loss for her family and for all of them, and they spoke beautifully. And you know, the president is very committed also to making sure that law enforcement has the resources and the respect that they deserve to be able to do their job. Somebody like the murderous cop in Minneapolis against George Floyd, he had more than a dozen complaints against him. The union is protecting him. He's eligible for a pension. I mean, there are all kinds of things that can be done so that
Kellyanne,
we make sure people are doing their job.
I want to ask you about what the president is getting ready to announce, an executive action on law enforcement as soon as tomorrow. Obviously, for all the reasons that you and I have been talking about for weeks now, this is so needed. So now it's time to drill down on what exactly that could look like, that announcement.
Sure. Well, there are several principles that have been discussed. Obviously, the president's been listening to many different people across the aisle and across the country when he is formulating these ideas, and he has a very large group of people helping him with that as well.
That from Kellyanne Conway earlier today on Fox News. And the president, in fact, did tell reporters he will have details on his executive orders. He'll do so tomorrow with a White House announcement. We'll be covering it live for the C-SPAN networks. Meanwhile, in this Tulsa World editorial, the following regarding the president's rally there on Saturday. Quote, "The president is coming to town this week for a campaign rally. It will be his first since such events were suspended earlier this year because of the COVID-19 shutdown. We don't know why he chose Tulsa, but we can't see any way that his visit will be good for the city. Tulsa is still dealing with the challenges created by a pandemic. This is the wrong time." The full editorial at TulsaWorld.com. Nevertheless, the Trump campaign doubling down on his plan for a large gathering Saturday evening. The president defending the decision earlier today.
Mr. President, earlier today you tweeted that you believed that you were being COVID shamed because of your decision to go ahead with the Tulsa rally on Saturday night. The director of the health department in the county and in the city has encouraged you to postpone that, saying they still think that they've got too big a COVID problem for you to pull off a rally like that. Your thoughts on it?
Well, Oklahoma's done very well. I just spoke to the governor. He's very excited about it. Governor Stitt, who's done a terrific job. Mike, I think you can maybe speak to this. He's done a great job. Oklahoma's at a very low number. They've done really fantastic work. They have a pretty new, magnificent arena As you probably have heard, and we're getting exact numbers out, but we're either close to or over 1 million people wanting to go. We have a 22,000-seat arena, but I think we're going to also take the convention hall next door, and that's going to hold 40,000. So we'll have 22,000 plus 40,000, which would mean that we'd have over 900,000 people that won't be able to go, but hopefully they'll be watching. But it's an amazing — nobody's ever heard of numbers like this. I think we're going to have a great time. We're going to talk about our nation. We're going to talk about where we're going, where we've come from. And I can tell you on COVID or coronavirus or whatever you want to call it, plenty of names, tremendous progress is being made. I spoke with the governor of Texas, where they've done a fantastic job, and he said they have had some outbreaks in prisons, and that's where their numbers went out. And the numbers change a little bit because of the prison population, but he's got it in great shape. Texas, Florida's doing very well. Georgia's doing very well. We have tremendous numbers. We have hot spots, as I said, you might, and we take care of the hot spots. But many of the governors have done a very good job, some not as good as others, some very good. But Oklahoma has been a place that I think one of the reasons we chose it is because of how well they — because it's early. It's very early. And because of what a great job the governor and everybody else has done in Oklahoma. And we expect to have, you know, it's like a record-setting crowd. We've never had an empty seat, and we certainly won't in Oklahoma.
And that rally getting underway at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, 7 o'clock local time this Saturday. It will be live on C-SPAN television. Also from the White House, this from Senior Counselor Kellyanne Conway. She spoke to reporters on the North Lawn.
So I saw the campaign tweeted out today. They've got about a million RSVPs. That's quite extraordinary. I know Wildwood had been the record before that, 100 and some thousand, so it's pretty extraordinary. And that they're doing temperature checks, giving everybody a face mask and hand sanitizer. So I think it sounds like the campaign is taking steps that comport with what the CDC has said and possibly even local Tulsa or state Oklahoma guidelines. I'd have to look at that and see what phase they're in. I think they're pretty well along there in Oklahoma. So that's good. It's a recognition that there are guidelines in place that should be followed. And we want everybody to have, you know, safety and still to be able to participate in gatherings like that. I, you know, read the paper last night. People were out in Central Park. In fact, one headline said that many people didn't have masks and some people didn't have pants. New York Post headline, amazing. So I didn't click on and read the rest of it, but we certainly hope that the people in Oklahoma will adhere to all the reasonable guidelines and have fun. Sure. So we meet regularly, though. I think we had two meetings last week, if I recall. Correct. But you have access to them. I see Dr. Fauci is interviewed still, you know, at a pretty quick clip, still regularly, and others are asked these questions and answering them. I do think my own opinion is we should get a lot of that messaging out there, because not even messaging, the facts and figures out there, because just to keep the public informed, especially now that we're not in the day-by-day increase in cases, increase in deaths, where are the ventilators? I mean, that was a very fraught time for the whole country. And so to be able to provide the information now so people know where we are, in which states and where we're going, would be very useful, whether it's a formal task force briefing or Kaylee answers the questions in her press briefing, or the president has asked them in an open pool spray, or the doctors are on hand, or the doctors are on TV or radio or in print being asked the questions. I think that all has great value for the country. Yes, I do.
That briefing earlier today with Kellyanne Conway at the White House. The Federal Reserve today announcing it will begin to expand a previously announced program to purchase bonds of U.S. companies that were highly rated back in mid-March at the start of COVID-19. According to the Wall Street Journal, the central bank has deployed a $250 billion lending program to buy those outstanding corporate bonds and a separate $500 billion effort to buy newly issued debt. Wall Street liked what it heard. At the closing bell, the Dow recovered from earlier losses, gaining 157 points. The NASDAQ rose 137, the S&P gaining 25. Another indicator of the economy and any recovery is how quickly businesses rehire those employees who were laid off as a result of the pandemic. Consumer and business spending remain down, which means a recovery may be slower and longer than initially expected. Washington Post financial writer David Lynch has been looking into that story.
Well, Steve, you know, the good news is the May jobs report seemed to indicate some faster than expected recovery, at least in the labor market, which is great. But economists are saying that while we're liable to get a quick initial bounce off the bottom of this very deep recession, after that, that'll be the easy part. And after that, according to Mark Zandi at Moody's, we're liable to sort of trend sideways for a bit after we regain, say, 70-80% of what we had back in February. And getting that last increment of normalcy, if you will, is going to be the hard part and may well not be achievable until we get a vaccine for this virus.
And you frame your story in part based on a small sandwich shop in Western Michigan, in Whitehall, Michigan. What did you learn?
Well, you know, it's interesting the way that this pandemic has played out. It started, if you go back to January when I and many others, of course, started writing about this, it began as a what seemed to be a supply shock coming out of China, that the Chinese factories would be shut down and that would interrupt global supply chains, and so American companies would be inconvenienced. Perhaps their production would be disrupted or interrupted. And since then, as the disease has spread around the globe and as the nature of the shock has sort of propagated through the economy and through the global economy, it's hit the demand side of things. And so folks, millions of American consumers are stuck at home until quite recently, can't or won't go out to restaurants and movie theaters and concerts and sporting events. And all of this acts as a series of dominoes. And we tried to make it understandable by starting with airlines canceling their flights to China. That, of course, is bad news for the companies that make commercial aircraft, Boeing and Airbus. They tighten up. That's bad news for their suppliers, the producers of jet engines and the parts that go into these jet engines. One of these companies is Howmet Aerospace, which has a sizable operation in Whitehall, Michigan. And, you know, right before the pandemic hit, they were anticipating a very strong year and a very strong several years, in fact, from a secular trend of increasing airline travel. And that obviously has all changed. And so they've now laid off almost a quarter of their workforce, their 2,800 workers in Whitehall. And that layoff then results in, you know, 600 people with less money to spend on new cars or on vacations or clothes or you name it. And one specific is this charming little sandwich shop just down the street from the factory. The workers, many of them would come in there every day for lunch. They're not coming, or fewer of them are coming. And the factory also, anytime they had a big sales meeting or a special function of some kind, they might place an order for, say, 1,000 lunches. That's a lot of business, a lot of revenue that's now vanished for this shop. And so, you know, as a consequence, they're not hiring their usual complement of college kids to work waiting the tables and standing behind the counter. For the first time in 30 years, they're not adding any additional positions, and they're wondering whether they're even going to be able to make it through the winter. They need to earn all their, not all their money, but a great deal of their money in the summer to sort of carry them through the slow period of the winter.
We're talking with David Lynch of the Washington Post, and as you point out in your story, this is a very quick recession. Some say it may be a quick recovery, a V-shaped recovery. Do you expect that?
I think, you know, the way I look at it is when can we get back to to what we had in February. If you go back just a few weeks before everything shut down, we had the economy was in the midst of the longest expansion on record, 11 years or so. Unemployment was at a 50-year low of about 3.5%. It wasn't incredible growth, but it was about 2% steady annual growth. It was a nice, healthy, robust economy. And how can we get back to that? How can we recapture 100% of that? Well, it's hard to imagine, for me anyway, getting the restaurant business and the entertainment business and sports and all the rest of it back to 100% before a vaccine. And the optimists say that might be available early next year, but then you've got to roll it out, get everybody vaccinated. Anyway, a long way of saying many economists don't say we'll get our fourth quarter 2019 production back until the end of next year. So we would have lost 2 years of growth, and then we'll sort of be starting from scratch at that point. So it's going to be a couple of years, I think.
The story is available at WashingtonPost.com. David Lynch, who covers business and the economy, thank you for being with us.
Anytime.
Also today, the Trump administration planning to file a lawsuit blocking next week's release of a book authored by former National Security Advisor John Bolton. The former Trump advisor left the administration back in September, and in his memoir, The Room Where It Happened, it had been expected to be released earlier this year, but the book underwent a standard review for classified information by the National Security Council, delaying its release. By the way, the book's title is based on the hit Broadway musical Hamilton.
Mr. President, can you say why you're suing John Bolton to prevent publishing his book?
Well, I don't know. I'd have to ask the Attorney General, but I will say if he's doing a book, I think it's totally inappropriate that he does a book. I think I gave him a break. He couldn't get Senate confirmed. He was never Senate confirmed the first time. I don't think he's supposed to even be calling himself an ambassador because he couldn't get Senate confirmed. He got in through a little trick, and he was there for a fairly short period of time. I put him here because he couldn't get Senate confirmed. This was a non-Senate confirmed position, as you know. He stayed for a short while, and I felt that it was not appropriate that he stay any longer. I wasn't impressed. And somebody said he went out and wrote a book. If he wrote a book, I can't imagine that he can, because that's highly classified information. Even conversations with me, they're highly classified. I told that to the Attorney General before. I will consider every conversation with me as president highly classified. So that would mean that if he wrote a book, and if the book gets out, he's broken the law. And I would think that he would have criminal problems. I hope so. Otherwise, I mean, they put a sailor in jail because he sent a photograph of his bed and an engine of an old submarine. And if this guy's writing things about conversations or about anything, and maybe he's not telling the truth. He's been known not to tell the truth a lot. So we'll have to see what the book is all about. But, a lot of people are upset with him for writing a book. A lot of people are very angry with him for writing a book. But it's up to the Attorney General. Bill, do you have anything to say about it?
Well, people who come to work in the government and have access to sensitive information generally sign an agreement that says that when they leave government, if they write something that has draws on or might reflect some of the information they've had access to, they have to go through a clearance process before they can publish the book. And we don't believe that Bolton went through that process, hasn't completed the process, and therefore is in violation of that agreement.
So what is the DOJ doing? And that's criminal liability, by the way, you're talking about. You're not talking about, like, he's got to return $3 that he made on a book. That's called criminal liability. That's a big thing. You know, Hillary Clinton, she deleted 33,000 emails. And if we ever found out what those emails say, she would have had a liability. That's what you have. You have a liability.
Well, that with the president earlier today at the White House, along with his attorney general. John Bolton, by the way, is not the only former Trump national security advisor out with a new book. We learned that H.R. McMaster has one slated for publication in September. Washington Today is available on C-SPAN Radio and as a podcast. You can find it searching on our website at cspan.org/podcast, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at C-SPAN Radio. For this Monday, June 15th, I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Enjoy the rest of your evening.